In this week's riveting episode, we unearth the haunting tale of a teenager who, against all odds, predicted her own demise. A chilling journey into the realm of premonitions awaits as we unravel the threads of destiny. But that's not all. Brace yourselves for a journey to the heart of a rural enigma. Picture this, a farmer's encounter with a creature that defies explanation, a cow-like behemoth prowling the outskirts, leaving behind a trail of bewilderment. The line between myth and reality blurs in this hair-raising account that will challenge your perceptions of the known. And if you thought the desert was just a sea of sand, think again. We unveil the mystery of a peculiar door nestled in the vastness of the Las Vegas desert. This week on Strange Pathways. Welcome back, dedicated listeners. It has been a while, hasn't it? And for that, I owe you an apology. You know, I was just burned out. I was absolutely burned out. I don't know if I was trying to take on too much, if there was too much going on in my own life, if it was the change in the seasons, and or maybe a little bit of all three. And that's probably where the truth lies. But I'm going to try to get back to a more regular schedule. And these past few months, they've been necessary. They've been an absolutely necessary respite to confront the weight of just life on my shoulders. But tonight, I return to you with tales that will leave you questioning the very fabric of reality. Now, I want to express my utmost gratitude for your patience and understanding during my hiatus. Before we dive into these three new tales, let me allude to an upcoming special. And this is going to be a story so grave and clandestine that it has given me nightmares. There's always, no matter what, there is always going to be some question as to whether ghosts, cryptids, the supernatural exists. But there are times when we, normal human beings, are called towards something greater. And I have an interview coming up with a man who, against all odds, played an amazingly pivotal role in dismantling his own sister's cult. Now, the details are harrowing, and the truth of this is an absolute testament to the persistence of the human spirit in the face of the extraordinary. Let me give you just a little taste of what's to come.
These women would come through, and I knew they were like the vicious women who had girls or young women or whatever who were trying this thing out to see if they liked it, right? That's all I knew. But I knew that they get lodging and food, and I'm sure cash exchanged hands, you know, my parents and my sister. So there was this pipeline. My parents' house became a pipeline. That's integral to the rest of the story. But so I just grew up around this. I just grew around this thing and trying to ignore it as much as I could. And while my mom would say she kind of hated it, she didn't stop it. She kept it going. Mm-hmm. So that's how this familiarity with them and the whole thing happened. So their public face was, I don't know, dude. I mean, I'm guessing teaching, because I know that, and I'm guessing teaching. That's all you mean is teaching. All I remember anybody doing.
From my research, you know, you have the standard vowels that whenever somebody joins a monastery, you know, you have the vow of poverty, you have the vow of chastity. But it did seem that the Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate had this very unique fourth vowel. And they had a pledge to be at God's disposal without reserve for the greatest glory of God through the salvation of all in Jesus Christ. So there was this very unique fourth vow, But finding anything outside of the allegations is almost impossible.
You're right.
The Wikipedia article is six lines. Six lines long.
Well, if you get a chance, go to the talk page. Did I tell you that?
Yes, yes.
Their new one is now six lines. That thing has been written and rewritten like over a dozen times, at least, over the years. Because I think I know who it is. We'll get to her later, but someone has only got to be, it's got to be the one person. Well, no, there could be others, but I think it's one. I think it could be the woman, the other member of the cult that lives with my sister in my deceased mom's house. I think she's the one, because she was the youngest one that I knew of, so she's probably internet savvy. Mm-hmm. So she may have gone and do it. But there are enough people afraid. There were enough people afraid of Patrizzi. Their footprint is impossible. You're right. I mean, it's like you go Google them, you're like, I don't know. That's, yeah, so you're not wrong.
Look for that interview with Mike coming up in an upcoming episode of Strange Pathways. But right now, we gather once again in the realms of shadows and mysteries. So prepare yourself for 30 or so minutes of reflection and chilling revelations. On to our first tale. Catherine Hobbs struggled greatly with her parents getting a divorce. At the time, Kathy was just 8 years old, and her mother had gained custody. She missed her father immensely. It was around this time that Kathy started talking about her own death. Tragedy hit Catherine once again in the seventh grade. One of her close friends died of a heart attack. It was at this point that Kathy began musing to her family that she didn't believe she'd make it past the age of 16. Kathy and her family had moved to Las Vegas for the sole reason of giving Kathy a fresh start. And it worked. She made new friends. Her attitude improved. But as she got closer to turning 16, Kathy's fear of dying came back. She even started to embrace it. Kathy had told her mother that she didn't want to grow up. She didn't want to become older. And that she didn't think she'd make it to her 16th birthday. But on her 16th birthday, Kathy was relieved to wake up alive, surprised, excited, started making plans for the future. And this lifted her family's spirit. Kathy had become more enthusiastic about life, even started going out again, hanging out with friends. On the evening of July 23rd, 1987, Kathy Hobbs, now a happy 16-year-old, was at her home in Las Vegas. She was reading a romance book in her bedroom. And she finished it. But like so many of us, she craved more. Around 11 p.m., she told her mother, Vivian, that she was going to go to the nearby supermarket to buy a new book. She looked at her mother and said, "Give me a kiss before I go." And mother goes, "Why? I'm still going to be awake whenever you get back." And Kathy told her that, "I might stop, chat with some friends. You might be asleep when I get back." Vivian says, "Okay." Gives her a kiss. And that's the last Vivian ever saw of her daughter. Kathy going to the local store that late at night was not an odd occurrence. And staying out to chat with her friends usually hung out at the apartment swimming pool late at night. Her mother wasn't concerned. And thinking that Kathy was with her friends, Vivian went to sleep. But at 3 a.m., Vivian had a strange dream that startled her, woke her up. Vivian described it as being hit on the head. And then she had a very peaceful feeling and thought to herself, it's all over. And fell back asleep. The next morning, whenever Vivian awoke, Vivian realized Kathy had never come home. Las Vegas Metro Police Homicide Lieutenant Kyle L. Edwards was assigned the case. Now, during the first important day of the investigation, Kyle Edwards located her friends, her family. The police launched an extensive media campaign. Catherine's picture was all over the television. But by the end of the second day, they had suspected that Catherine had probably been taken by someone. Later, a store clerk remembered seeing Kathy at the supermarket on the night she disappeared. They checked the receipts, and it showed that someone had bought a paperback book at 11:17 that night. So Kathy did make it to the store, but she did not make it home. 9 days after Kathy disappears, hiker Rick Pakult finds her body near Lake Mead in the desert. The police arrived quickly. They were sure it was Kathy. They found tire marks where a vehicle had come, turn around and left. They found two rocks with Kathy's blood on them. Kathy's cause of death was determined to be multiple head wounds from that rock. 3 months after Kathy's disappearance, an anonymous caller contacted the Las Vegas police. They said that they saw a girl being grabbed in front of that same store by a guy named Robbie. This caller even gave the car's license plate number, but they didn't leave their name nor their phone number. And whenever the police checked, they found that the license plate did not exist. To this very day, Kathy's murder is unsolved. The police do suspect that serial killer Michael Lee Lockhart was involved with Kathy's murder. Lockhart was arrested for another murder, put on trial, convicted, and even executed. After Kathy died, the family had found letters in her room, written 1 month before her 16th birthday. The letter to her mother Vivian read, "Dear Mother, in the event of my death, you shall get this letter. I hope you live happily, and I don't want you or anyone else to dwell on my death. I love you all very dearly. You were good to me, and nobody else could have been a better mother. Keep me alive in your heart, and don't ever forget me. Love always, Kathy." Was Catherine Hobbs really able to predict her own death, or was this just an amazing coincidence? Our next tale is going to take us back to December 2nd, 1974, near Frederick, Wisconsin. William Bosack is a dairy farmer in Polk County, Wisconsin. He had just attended a co-op meeting and was driving southeast on his way home. He didn't really have time to look up UFOs, aliens, ghosts, all that stuff. No, no, no. William Bosack was a practical man. So I don't believe anyone would have been more stunned than he when he had a run-in with a strange, strange creature. Bosak was making his way through the low-hanging patches of dense fog over that road that led to the 450-acre farm, which he had owned and operated for over 40 years. Now, less than a mile from his home, at around 10:30 at night, Bosak's headlights caught a glint of a conical, capsule-shaped object that was hovering off in the distance. Bosak had described it as a curved front of glass, and inside, he could see a figure with its arms raised above its head. It had hair sticking out from the sides of its head, and the ears protruding out about 3 inches. And these ears were shaped like a calf's ear. This being had no collar or shirt with a seam in front, but it appeared to be clothed in something tannish brown in color and fitted skin tight like a diver's suit. Both arms were extended above its head, and its hair stuck out from the outside of the arms. No beard, but there was hair or fur on the upper part of the body. The rest of it, though, from the waist down, not visible because of the fog. William Bosak was overcome with a great fear. And when he was interviewed later, Bosak said he was pretty remorseful. He left behind a mystery. And he really, really wished he would have stopped to show this strange thing, the cowman, that he was friendly. I do find it very interesting that a dairy farmer sees an entity that has these features of a cow. Don't you? Probably the animal that he's most familiar with. The animal that he's most in contact with. It's, maybe people see Bigfoot, because this does seem like one of those weird UFO Bigfoot encounters. Maybe people see Bigfoot as this purely humanoid thing, because that's the creature we're most comfortable with, ourselves. But something that reached into Bosak's mind saw that maybe this man was just as comfortable with cows as he was with humans, and kind of meshed the two up so that he wouldn't go mad seeing what the truth really was. Men and women who are much more intelligent than me have theorized that these entities that we see time after time after time, what would have been gnomes 200 years ago, 500 years ago would have been fairies, 1,000 years ago would have been gods, might be the same creatures, and I do hesitate to use that word, creatures, but they might be the same creatures that we see today, wearing masks, in a very broad sense of the term, putting on a different disguise for us to make it more palatable. What do these creatures really look like? I don't think, not only do I not think that we're meant to know, I don't think we can know. Maybe they don't look like anything. Maybe they look like everything. But the Bosak cowman remains in my mind one of the more interesting, albeit short, cases in ufology. This 8 to 10 foot tall cow person in a clear bubble that just happened to show itself to a dairy farmer? That can't be coincidence. There has to be something to that. Our last tale is going to take us back to Las Vegas and back to phantomsandmonsters.com. Did you really think I could stay away? Now, this was an account given to Lon Strickler over at Phantoms and Monsters from Steve Riri. At the time, Steve was the chairman of the Silent Heroes of the Cold War National Memorial Committee in Las Vegas. Steve had worked with the U.S. government in various capacities. And Steve had come to know this story from a close friend of his, Doug, that he had known for many, many years. Doug was an amazingly successful businessman. And Steve says, there is no question of this man's integrity. Now, Doug goes into Steve's office and he tells Steve about this conversation he had with one of his longtime customers. Doug decides to give this customer the name John. Even though that's not his real name, he does it to protect his identity. So John sits down. He looks at Doug and says, do you believe in UFOs? Now, Doug had only known John for a short time, but he knows that John was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and he's got accolades and credentials out the wazoo. This man is the pinnacle of integrity. He does tell John that UFOs, yeah, I believe in them. There are things that are flying that we don't know what they are. They're unidentifiable. That's the U in UFO. Unidentified. But John accepts this. He begins to tell Doug this story about an elderly friend who lived close to John. And Doug calls this friend Tom. Tom asks John the same question. Do you believe in UFOs? And John says, yes. He tells John, I want to show you something, but I gotta take you to Las Vegas. So Tom and John end up driving. They drive to the corner of Tropicana and Decatur Boulevard, a few miles west of the Las Vegas Strip. This place, the locals call it the Pits. And it's got a lot of dirt mounds, and dirt bike enthusiasts love to ride there. Now, even though this is not very far from the Las Vegas Strip, it's undeveloped. The cost of leveling the ground and its location is a major wash heading towards Las Vegas. It's just not feasible to develop it. Tom and John arrive at the Pits. They pull off into the desert and they walk to a spot. And Tom goes, stop. Tom gets out a metal detector and does some searching. And then all of a sudden this detector becomes alive. He places a rock at that point. And then Tom goes off in another direction. The detector sounds again. He places another rock there. And he repeats this until he gets an equilateral triangle. Tom keeps checking his watch the whole way through this. All three corners of the triangle have been placed, and he begins to feel his way to the center of this triangle. Tom steps aside, places John in the dead center of the triangle. Tom steps back, looks at his watch, and waits. And he looks at him and goes, John, in a minute you will feel a pulse through your body. The points of the triangle are places where the transmission pillars have been buried deep in the earth. In the center of these transmission pillars, where you now stand, is where the transmission waves will be generated. Where they are transmitting to, I don't know. But I do know these transmissions occur at regular intervals during the late night. And when they occur, you can feel them. They are about to transmit any minute now. And they both wait. And then just as Tom described, John feels a sensation, a physical force, like an electrical pulse rolling up his body from his toes into his head. John said it was like a group of people surrounding you with rolling pins, and they're just rolling them up your body from the toes to the top of your head. It didn't last long. It stops as suddenly as it starts. And it's never made clear to John how Tom knew this would happen. Tom, for some reason, knows about this alien information and was sworn to secrecy. The only reason Tom gave for showing John any of this at all, was, quote, just in case. Now Tom takes John on a drive outside of Las Vegas. They head west on the Blue Diamond Highway leading towards Pahrump, Nevada. We all know who lives in Pahrump. Well, lived, sadly. I miss Art Bell. I miss Art Bell so, so much. There will never be another like him. I miss him so much. So they get to this town, Blue Diamond. It's about 20 miles southwest of Las Vegas. At some point near Blue Diamond, Tom decides, hey, it's time to drive off the highway, and we're going to head into the desert. And Tom looks at John and goes, I need to show you something. I need to get this off my chest. At Tom's advanced age, he just wanted someone else to know some of what he knew. Tom and John go deeper and deeper and deeper into the desert. Cactus rushing past them. And they get to a door in the middle of nowhere set into the side of a rocky bluff. Tom just wanted John to see this door. And they only stay a moment. And Tom looks at John and goes, we have to leave right now. They know we're here. They drive away from this door. And suddenly, lights appear everywhere. Out of nowhere, it's headlights. Headlights. These lights tail them no less than 3 feet off the back of their bumper. Without warning, the lights go black. There's no lights, there's no vehicles. Only darkness. Days after this strange experience, John looked for Tom, couldn't find him. Tom's home is empty. None of his neighbors knew where he went. None of them saw him leave. The only clue, a neighbor across the street saw men in white hazmat suits take all of Tom's belongings. Psychologically, John can't get past this. He decides he's going to go revisit the transmission site. So late one evening, he makes a detour to the pits. He can't pull off the road. Someone has erected a dirt berm. So he parks his truck on the shoulder of the road. He gets out, climbs up over the berm. And instead of that dark, vacant area, days before, now laid out before him, construction equipment. And construction equipment. And more construction equipment. And these lights flooding the entire area. He lays down on his stomach, looks over to see what all the commotion is about. Floodlights all around the construction site turn and point their beams directly at his position. John quickly leaves the area, drives home. He does a little investigating. John learns that the city of Las Vegas has started construction on a flood retention basin and a park. But where was Tom? John eventually gets over the fear, shares his experience with a couple of friends, and a couple of them go, "I'm curious. I want to see this." So they take one of his friend's vehicles, and at one point they're driving the dirt road. John begins to feel nervous and scared. John is so terrified, he considers telling his friend to take a wrong turn and act like he'd forgotten the directions. As they drive along ahead, they saw an old pickup truck that had pulled off alongside the dirt road. They approach, and they can make out an extremely tall, thin man leaning against the driver's door. They pulled up behind the truck, and the tall man walked up to the driver's window and goes, "What are you doing out here?" John's friend says, "We're just driving around." And that tall man says, "You need to turn around. You've driven onto private property." John's friend pushes back against this attitude. And you go, "Who are you?" And the guy says, "I'm the law out here." This guy wasn't wearing any uniform. He didn't flash a badge. He had no sign of authority to offer whatsoever. That tall man straightens up, slowly walks around the vehicle, and lowers his head into the passenger's window where John is sitting. When he was face to face with John, he raised his sunglasses and looked him directly into his eyes. The tall man's eyes were not human. They were more feline with the slit pupil. And he addresses Tom by his full name and then follows it up with, "Consider this your warning. Do we have an understanding?" John says, "Yes." And John and his friend drive away. Doug has approached John since talking to Steve and asked him, "Would you be willing to take us to the door?" And John's answer, unsurprisingly, is no. Thank you for joining us once again here on Strange Pathways. This is the spot where I usually give the Twitter, the Facebook, everything like that. This is more important. I will say this. If anyone here listening has been or know of somebody who was part of the Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate Religious Order, please reach out to me. Please reach out to me. It is probably the most important thing I will ever do on this podcast. Once again, if you or someone you know was a member of the Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate Religious Order, please reach out to me at strangepathwaysmail@gmail.com. One more time, strangepathwaysmail@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourselves. A lesson that I am still learning. And each other.